Briefly, the first will be Andrea Gavrich. She is affiliated with the Giessen Center for Eastern European Studies and has a holds a chair for political science with a focus on integration at Giessen University. Her main fields actually are international organizations, EU, OSCE, European Council, NATO, and she currently has a project that deals with the comparison of conflict regions and international kind of, a conflict management, so to speak. So, and she will go first. Then, I have to look that up. Second will be Olga Sesneva. The dual affiliation actually is quite interesting. We heard a lot about the European University in St. Petersburg, but you have a second or first, whatever it would be, affiliation at the University of Amsterdam. And Olga Sesneva is assistant professor at the Department of Sociology and the visiting professor of urban studies at the European University of St. Petersburg. And she received her PhD in sociology from New York University and has a very good track record on also including economic issues, global perspectives into our topic. The third speaker of this roundtable discussion will be Anna Veronika Wendland. We're happy to have her here at the Herder Institute as a coordinator for the scientific program planning and also project management. She is just about to finish a project on nuclear security issues, with, of course, Chernobyl is the keyword, with a focus on Eastern Europe. She's a historian with the Eastern European focus, mainly on East Central Europe, and she's an excellent person, very much as person for also political expertise when it comes to Ukraine. And last but not least, while we have we had the pleasure to listen to Jan-Willem Döventag already, he is currently the chair, I think, for 2 years now of the Council for European Studies and also affiliated with Amsterdam Universities, a university holding their chair for sociology. And his research interests, and that reflects very much also in his publications, his social movements, urban studies. Also, interestingly enough, culturization of citizenship, gender and sexuality. So quite broad range of aspects, and we already I build up a little anxiety about what your final statement might be. So, as I have mentioned at the very beginning of the symposium, we have a very timely topic where we still are looking, and I think the need is to create tools for linking theory and practice in this. And actually, we could just begin with also asking where do you see security studies in terms of the current challenges to all of you? Can you think of examples or best practice or worst case scenarios of applying theoretical concepts to conflict solution? Where do you see the role of experts in the future? The intersection of different categories, we had that in my introduction. Does it help us to understand political processes? So Andrea.
Okay, thank you very much.
The floor is yours.
Thank you, and all the other organizers of this conference. Yeah, honestly, I just realized while I prepared myself for this roundtable discussion that I started now 20 years ago already working on minority issues, because I did my PhD on minority policies in Poland. So I started only a couple of years after all these important basic documents have been established in the beginning of the 90s. And the core topic I would like to concentrate now is a bit like a, after 20 years, starting on the topic, it's a bit like a review of the European minority rights regime. So, and I will link it to the security issue also, just to bring both aspects together. Yeah, I would like to start with the following argument. I think while I reviewed again these documents and the literature on the European minority rights regime, currently we do not need substantially new documents on minority protection. We even do not need new initiatives on desecuritization at the legal level, I would say, because to my mind all the documents are at hand which could be used but which are not applied in the way they should be. So we just need the implementation of the existing minority documents. Like, for example, there are a couple of documents which are not more too prominent currently, or which are overlooked. I, for example, for this short comment here at this roundtable, I had a look again at the Lund recommendations on the effective participation of national minorities in public life, which was initiated by the OSCE High Commissioner on National Minorities in 1999. And I think this is really a brilliant document which links minority protection with the democracy issue, which is for me at the moment a very important nexus, which is, and especially because we have now the dominance of the security debate, which has been overlooked. So I think we do not need new instruments of judicial institutions or new conditionality elements, things like that, especially because we all realized after the EU Eastern Enlargement that the EU conditionality did not work. So we have local requirements which are very important for implementing minority rights aspects. If these local requirements are not there, and this is my link to basic material and consolidated democracy issues, then also no conditionality helps. So we had a couple of studies analyzing and how far the EU's conditionality with regard to minority protection based on the Copenhagen criteria, how these work, and most of these studies have been very pessimistic about the effectiveness of conditionalities. So, in fact, we especially have to concentrate on the implementation gap of the existing documents, so that would be the most important point. After starting with this basic argument that I do not see any need for new tools or new documents, which was also among the couple of questions we received beforehand, I would like to address the second part of the debate we have currently in literature. In general, I think that the literature on minority protection currently is still too narrow. So I was, after reviewing literature again, now for the preparation of this roundtable, I was a bit disappointed and shocked that there are still the same authors publishing who have been publishing 20 years ago. So there's still, we need a broadening of the debate, let's say, maybe from my discipline, from political science. So I didn't review, of course, for history and neighboring disciplines, but okay, I feel that the debate is still a bit narrow. Nevertheless, we have a link between the security issue and the minority issue, and very interesting, for example, are the arguments from Galbraith and McEvoy in 2012. They evaluated the European minority rights regime, and they showed three substantial shortcomings regarding the implementation and monitoring of the existing European rights minority rights regime. The first one is well known for all of you, I think, the old and never-ending story between individual rights and group rights, so that the rights are granted to individuals but not to groups, even though the core documents we have on hand would allow that. The second point, maybe the most interesting, is that they evaluate the current minority rights document in the European minority rights regime, In that way, that they argue they follow the logic primarily of regional stability and less of minority protection itself. So it is minority protection somehow is subordinated under the regional stability issue. That is a very important point. Third point is they argue that minority protection is more important than the empowerment of minorities, so that the policies are oriented towards satisfying the needs somehow of the minorities, but not increasing the role of minorities. And they link these aspects with the debate on the de-securitization of the minority protection, which started in the early 2000s in political science literature. And so the desecuritization is one of the aims which scholars see with regard to future minority policy. How can that be reached? And debates are going this and that direction. So there are a couple of voices very pessimistic that it can be ever reached. And these authors say, which I think is very convincing, that this European minority rights regime from the European Union, the EU, and the Council of Europe is not able to desecuritize minority and majority relations because this would require to overcome the three shortcomings which I just introduced. So they argue it is this minority rights regime is somehow toothless, yeah? And how can we explain that? Why is it that way that the current European minority rights regime is regarded as toothless or not as properly addressing the problems we have? And this can be explained by the starting point of the today's European minority rights regime. It can be explained by the circumstances which you all know, under which the core documents we have today on hand emerged. So the first wave of minority protection has been taking place in the early 90s after the dissolution of the Soviet Union and the wars in Bosnia and Herzegovina and Kosovo, so I do not need to, it's not necessary to go into detail a bit more. And based on that, the documents like the Council of Europe Framework Convention or the Council of Europe Charter on Minority Language emerged, and especially also the OSCE High Commissioner on National Minorities, and later also then the Copenhagen Criteria was also in the early 90s. So all these emerged in a situation of emergency, in a situation of shock. So, and that is why these documents are mainly oriented in the direction of regional stability instead of empowerment of national minorities. This was followed then, after that we had a certain stagnation with regard to certain documents or improvement at the legal basis with regard to minority rights. And this was followed then by immediately after that, we had somehow the stagnation, but then we had 9/11, and 9/11 then brought with a second push to with regard to the securitization of the minority issue in a general way, because it linked it to terrorism issues, anti-terrorism, and migration issues. This blocked new innovative concepts after then. And the final step is then this current European refugee crisis since 2015. Also, this in general stresses this link again. Yeah, just we heard this with the paper during this afternoon. And this blocks new debates, further debates on improvement of minority protection policies. For example, modern debates could refer to non-territorial cultural autonomy aspects like this, but I would say that due to the securitization issue we had in the aftermath of 9/11 and then in the aftermath of the refugee crisis, this is in general somehow blocked. So, basically, the fact that the European rights regime emerged as a regional stability instrument and not as an instrument of substantial empowerment is the main obstacle for the implementation. But what I think, if I say we do not need new instruments and there's at hand, for example, the Lund recommendation is very far-reaching. It's not legally binding, only politically binding, but it's very far-reaching. And but it can be only applied if we have a full-fledged consolidated democracy. So for me, the core issue is the link between having a consolidated democracy or not and minority rights. So we should look more to the consolidation issue of democracy, and then parts of these, the documents can work we have on hand. That's why I think we do not need new instruments. So we need more explicit way the link between the minority protection issue and And the democracy issue, especially because from a political science perspective, I would think we could link it with current debates we have on the participation in current democracy states. We have participation in democracies is where we have a rather broad debate on increased participation in modern democracies now, but it is not linked to the minority issue in that way. Even though the documents would we have on hand, the OSCE Council of Europe documents would allow that and would help us. And so this is maybe the biggest problem we have, that this is not that we as scientists do not refer in a way which is necessary with regard to participation theories and minority issues in a way, and also political so practitioners also do not do that in that way. And I would like to close with some kind of quotation, or with a quotation from a former OSCE High Commissioner on National Minorities, who evaluated this Lund recommendation, which just gives interesting or establishes interesting rules on minority participation in democracies. And Knut Vollebæk states in 2009 on the role of minorities in democracies, talking about effective participation. So that is the issue. Minority participation in politics without influence is dangerous. It ultimately encourages those to advance their agendas outside the peaceful democratic framework. To my mind, this quotation links in a very easy and illustrative way the issues which are on hand and where we would have to look more in detail in the future of participation, a mature democracy, which means a democracy which also has tools for participation, and then a peaceful coexistence between minorities and majorities. Thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you so much. So actually, that was quite kind of a model-like idea of how it could work, how it would work. Olga, what? How do you react?
Well, I actually would like to start by thanking you, Peter, and thanking Nicole, and also Jan Willem for giving me the opportunity to be here. And she participated in this rather diverse and interdisciplinary discussion. But I also would like to take a moment to acknowledge the fact that the second institution of my affiliation, the European University of St. Petersburg, as of yesterday, ceased to exist. And the university was denied an educational license. On grounds of not providing adequate conditions for its students in material terms, in terms of the building, most notably for not having sports facilities
and a few water courses.
Yes.
What water facilities?
And its premises. It also, in the commentary given by the member of the regional parliament to the newspapers, the university was accused of threatening the security of cultural identity by supporting Center for Gender Studies and by actively promoting GBLT ideology, ethics, and culture. So this outright repressive, I want to say fascist measurements done in the name of security and the state of security. I think, unfortunately, in some dark way, resonate with our discussion, with our conversation today, there will be a set of actions in the coming weeks, petitions, appeals. If you are on social media, please keep an eye out on this action and react if you feel like reacting. So, my My heart is bleeding right now over this. But now to issues of securities and minorities, and I want to start with a disclaimer. I am not a specialist in minority studies. I'm a sociologist and I'm a historical sociologist who worked a lot on the issues of migration and mobility and the ways in which mobility articulates claims of ethnic and national identity. My today's commentary will be grounded in part in my own experience of researching the repopulation of East Prussia and West Prussia at the end of World War II as the Soviet Union and underwent a deep repopulation, reconstruction, and political change. The second project from which I will draw my observations and thoughts is more contemporary. It's an international study of mobility of Russian-speaking computer scientists or computer specialists. So as Russian coders, programmers, and computer scientists move around the world, they pose interesting identity issues, pose interesting questions about what minority is, and I don't need to tell you, they also pose quite peculiar and spectacular sort of state security issues. Soliciting special So, the experience of working on these topics and doing research on these topics prompts me to start my response to three excellent questions posed by Peter by offering a second-degree rendition of famous English proverb that one man's minority is another man's majority. And, you know, my retention of the masculine pronoun here is more accidental. Or if we are to introduce a historical axis here, then I would say today's minority may be yesterday's majority. And surely that what happened to the German majority that was expelled from eastern edge of the former German Reich in at the end of World War II. But that policy also perhaps interestingly, to policies that the Soviet Union practiced towards nationalities that were termed the suspect nationalities and eventually labeled and treated as enemy nationalities. And let me run a quick list. Between 1935 and 1938, in 3 years before the war, nine of such nationalities were labeled enemies. Poles, Germans, Finns, Estonians, Koreans, Chinese, Kurds, and Iranians. All of them became subjects of displacement, dispossession of their agricultural land, ethnic cleansing, and expulsion. So, all this went under the heading of state security. The oddity with which these names, the names of these nationalities, resonate today with us as ethnic minorities and ethnic as enemy nationalities should not be lost on us, and should not definitely be lost in this particular audience. What this unease that we may experience hearing that Poles, Germans, Finns, and Estonians were enemy nationalities reveals the constructedness of the whole array of categories, not least the category of minority and the category of security itself, their contingency. And I think this is actually a great purchase of historical study, the realization of contingent constructiveness of these categories. The Russian computer scientist study also, in a strange way, shows that weird things happen to ethnicity as Russians migrate. Their Russianness has little to do with their self-identification, with the language that they speak, or even their citizenship. Instead, being Russian scientists activate their particular notion of ethnicity, deeply, intimately related to their professional competence. To be a Russian computer scientist means operating successfully in five major programming languages, being a good problem solver, and so on and so forth. There is a long list of criteria by which computer scientists become Russian. So here, from Russia, not so much with love, but with cold. As the generous fund from the Russian Ministry of Education that I was here received suggests bringing back this Russian computer science to Russia as a matter, as a strategic matter of the future of the Russian state, which is now trying to attract its immigrants back and resettle them again. So what I'm saying might sound like a precursor of a well-practiced constructivist approach to minorities. It is, and it is not. First, I believe that it is necessary to continue to insist on the contingency of taxonomies that create quote-unquote minorities. And on the unequal salience of ethnicity depending on places, moments, and situations. It continues to be necessary to deploy social construction as a tool of analysis and a set of objective empirical findings. The pitfalls of confusing categories of practice and categories of analysis have been articulated a number of times. Researchers are not to legislate on categories of practice, including the practice of political and judicial and other institutions, including the state. Minority, as much as security, is one of these categories which happen to be extremely closely tied to the history and identity of social sciences, as in the opposition between the naturalness of the social order and the social constructiveness. So in this vein, I would encourage minority studies students to assume a more systemic stance and approach objects of their study, namely minorities, as a in themselves particular regimes of differentiation and inequality. So here, what I would like to stress or add to our already established constructivist approach is that let's also expand it and make it more systemic. Let's think about ontologies, about minorities and security as ontologies that emerge from within particular regimes of differentiation and, very importantly, inequality. So, this is about approaching minority as sociopolitical ontology and not relying too heavily on notions like democracy or economic conditions or even constitutions, which may at times sound as normative and even teleological entities. If I had more time, I would go into discussion of three of inspiring works that demonstrate how this type of program can be executed. But I would briefly, very briefly, name them. I have in mind here Jim and John Kamarov's book, Ethnicity Incorporated, which, if we speak about regimes of constructiveness and differentiation, does a very nice job of implicating the rise of ethnic entrepreneurialism during particular conditions of American Northwestern and South African colonies. I would gesture towards a recent book by Roger Brubaker, Franz, in which he takes up examples of Caitlin Jenner and Rachel Dolezal. Caitlin Jenner was able to become a woman, she transgendered, while Rachel Dolezal was accused of assuming identity as an African American for false reasons. And Roger Brubaker very interestingly discusses the rise of constructivist social theory as a regime within which these changes, these transformations in identity concept could take place. And finally, I would like to point out my own inspiration of looking at the Soviet policies of repopulation in the former German territories as a realization of a particular settler colonial project with very strong political economic underpinnings. So to me, my goal is let's not talk just about discourses or just about practices of individual institutions, but look for the ways in which they connect and come together in one and singular logic that makes possible our conversation today about minorities and security. And I think I will stop here, because there is a good time.
Okay, wow. Actually, I hope we will remember all these genetic suggestions for our discussion afterwards and tomorrow, because you're proposing actually ways out of that trap, discourse practice, and suggest a lot of kind of new wisdoms for dealing with the topic. But